Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everyone. First of all, I'd like to thank you for coming out to the Tattered Cover Bookstore and supporting your local and independently owned bookstores. It gives me great pleasure to introduce this evening's guest speaker, author and longtime undercover food writer, Jason Sheehan. Jason is a food writer for Westword, and in 2003, he won the James Beard Award for his essay, There's No Thing as Too Much Barbecue, which was then reprinted in the book This I Believe from NPR. Jason's work has also appeared in many volumes of the Best American Food Writing. I believe it's the last 5 years he's been involved with that. And tonight, Jason is here to present his new book, Cooking Dirty, A Story of Life, Sex, Love, and Death in the Kitchen. So without further ado, please join me in welcoming Jason Sheehan.
All right, so I'm going to thank you all again. I'm sure most of you had plenty of other interesting things to be doing tonight, but awesome that you all showed up here. One quick thing, because my boss would kill me if I didn't correct it. I actually won the Beard Award for work that I did for Westword while I was working there, not for the This I Believe piece. The This I Believe piece was awesome. Don't get me wrong. It should have won numerous awards, but it was actually for a few pieces I did for Westword in my very first few months on the job. So, I'm going to talk a little. I'm going to read a little. I'm going to try to save time for some questions. As any of you who even fairly regularly read Westword, you know I'm very long-winded. So I will try to keep everything short and sweet, and hopefully we'll actually have some time to, you know, answer some questions and sign a few books and do what I'm supposed to be doing here tonight. First thing I wanted to talk about is the title of the book. I'm only mentioning this because I've had so many questions about it, and because it's a fairly good comment on the state of the modern publishing industry. Cooking Dirty. Most people who see it think that I'm talking about cooking with dirty hands, cooking in dirty kitchens, cooking filthy food, or just generally being an unpleasant human being to be around. And while most of that is right, cooking dirty is actually a cook slang phrase, mostly from back east on the East Coast where I grew up. It's the only place I've ever heard it. It sort of means when you're a trained chef, when you're a working chef in good restaurants, and say you just, you know, you just lost your job, showed up drunk one too many nights, pissed off one too many people, wrote one too many specials of your own, and you're waiting to get another gig. Maybe you've got a kitchen waiting, maybe you've got a buddy who's going to hire you somewhere else, but you need to pay the rent in the meantime, so you take a job in a diner, in a bar, in a roadhouse, something like that. That's cooking dirty. It's the stuff that you do between your real gigs, the stuff that you do and you would never admit to on your resume later, just to pay the rent and stuff like that. Funny thing about it is that this was not the original title of my book. My editor at Farrar, who is a brilliant man and has made just about every right choice there was to make with this book, decided that he didn't like the title because it was too, my original title, because it was too slangy. It was too insidery cook stuff. And it was another, you know, it was another cook slang kind of thing. It was called Whiskey Down, was the original title. He decided, no, it sounds like an alcohol memoir, sounds like this, sounds like that. And I tried to explain that, no, this is just cook slang. Whiskey Down is cook slang for an order of rye toast when you're working in a diner. He didn't get it. They actually went to a they actually went to a meeting. It was talked about by way too many people. And I never told him that cooking dirty was also cook slang. And unfortunately, while we were working through the book, the scenes in which I explained what cooking dirty actually meant were also cut from the book. So by the time it actually saw publication, nobody knew what cooking dirty actually meant. Now you all do. You're the 50 or 60 people, the only 50 or 60 people apparently on Earth who know what that phrase means, other than me. So lucky you. I'm going to read a chunk. I'm probably going to talk some more. Maybe I'll read another chunk, depending on how things go. I'm going to start easy. I'm going to go right from the beginning, so we don't need any setup, anything like that. And here we go. I apologize to anyone in advance who's offended. We had this superstition in the kitchen. On Fridays, no one counted heads. No one counted tables at the end of the night. No one counted covers. When the last table was cleared, the dupes were just left there, mounted up on the spike. You didn't look, not even in secret. No one even guessed. Bad things would happen if you did. And even though no one looked, bad things happened anyway. Lane died on a Friday night due to complications of lifestyle, which is to say he was shot by an acquaintance in a squabble over $20 worth of shitty brown horse. He wasn't found until Saturday morning. No one thought to call the restaurant to let us know that he wouldn't be coming into work that day. He was just considered AWOL, a no-call, no-show that left the line a man short going into the early bird rush. This was Tampa, Florida in the middle 90s. A bad time for cuisine, a worse place. It wasn't a great time for me either. Worse for Lane, I guess, but everything is a matter of degrees, of right and wrong places, right and wrong times. Eventually, Lane's name was found in the late edition of the Tampa paper, or maybe someone saw it on TV, I don't remember. In any event, we all found out, precisely too fucking late, that Lane was now fry cooking in the suite hereafter. The first hit was due in soon, and while there's a lot of voodoo in the air down in Florida, no one wanted to bet heavy on the long odds of Lane coming back as a zombie, retaking his place on the line. He'd been shit as a living cook anyhow. Being newly undead would probably only slow him worse than the smack head. This is why cooks should always have the decency to die in a public place, said Floyd, the kitchen manager and nominal chef. That way they make the morning paper, and we know who isn't showing up for work. In the kitchen, we discuss the best methods for dying in a spectacularly newsworthy fashion. By the way, the winner was falling naked from a tall building or a plane onto a group of school children larger than 6, or the President of the United States. spectacularly newsworthy fashion, etc., etc. And Floyd promoted one of the afternoon prep crew into Lane's slot on the line. The FNG, the fucking new guy, went on Fryers. It was my fourth night on the line at Jimmy's Crab Shack, and no longer the effingest NG, I was breveted to grill steamer, working beside Sturgis, who was grill top. Saturday night, early, no one was able to find a rhythm. We kept getting popped, then stalled, taking 5 tables like bang, 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 then nothing for 10 minutes. The FNG fell into the weeds, Don's Lemerit even at this stuttering half-speed. Jimmy, the owner, was antsy on expo, alternating between giggling fits and bouts of screaming obscenity. Floyd rotated the line out for cigarettes. He had a speed pour filled with rum and hurricane mix in the rack, and he sucked at it like a baby with a bottle, jumped on every check out of the printer as if it were the harbinger of the rush that steadfastly refused to come. It was difficult to see from the grill station at one end of the line to the fryers on the other because of the wavy heat haze, the air squirming like staring through aquarium water. 5 o'clock came and went. With the ventilation hood going full blast, Roberto and Chachi couldn't keep the pilots on their unused burners going, so had to keep kissing them back to life, leaning over and blowing across the palms of their hands to get the flame to jump from one to the next. With the gas turned all the way up. The alternative method, smacking down a pan on the grate at an angle and hard enough to catch a spark. They did it over and over again until Floyd yelled at him to quit it. After that, they fought over the galley radio. After that, they amused themselves by drinking the cooking wine and pegging frozen mushroom caps at Jimmy whenever his back was turned. At some point, Jimmy, in an attempt to catch whoever was throwing things at him and half in the bag to begin with, spun around too fast, caught his foot on the edge of one of the kitchen mats, and went down hard, his head spanging off the rounded edge of the expo table with a sound like someone throwing a melon at a gong. He was unconscious before he hit the floor. There was an instant of shocked silence, then a crashing wave of laughter. Seeing anyone fall down is funny, but seeing a drunken fat man fall down beats everything. One of the waitresses ran for the hostess, and she came at the best sprint she could manage in her stiletto heels and stirrup pants. The prep runner crew treated Jimmy like any other heat casualty, breaking in a wing and descending like Stukas to drag him clear of the flow of service. It took 4 of them. Jimmy was a big man, and moving him was like trying to roll a beached whale back into the sea. They dumped him, loose-jointed, beside the cooler and calmly went back about their business. Jimmy's t-shirt rode up over his hairy pony-kick belly, his eyes were closed. There was no blood, which secretly disappointed us all. Floyd spoke to the line, "No one cops to this. No one snitches." He ordered Roberto to the wheel, shifted Dump, the roundsman from second steamer, backing me to second fryer, backing the new FNG, and vaulted the line to take Jimmy's place at Expo himself. As was only to be expected, this was when the real dinner hit finally came tumbling in. With the hostess seeing to Jimmy, and probably quietly looking to see how she could get at his wallet, the floor was left unmanaged. Waitresses double and triple sat their own sections in the absence of an egalitarian hand, and the ticket machine began to spit. Like a pro, Roberto false-called a dozen steaks to the grill, crabs to the steamers, and 20 up fries to get things rolling in anticipation of steaks going well done and missed sides down the line, then started working actual tickets, hanging them 10 at a time. The machine didn't stop. The paper strip grew long, dripping like a tongue, spooling out and down onto the floor. On the galley radio, the DJ came back from a commercial break and kicked into the Misfits doing ballroom blitz, and I, up to my wrists in meat and blood, crouching down at the lowboy trying to retrieve cheap-ass skirts and backpack T-bones from the dim interior, yelled that I would kill the next cocksucking motherfucker that touched the dial. After that, we were in it. The machinery in motion. So that's a good start. It only gets weirder from there on out. So that's actually a pretty good example of what cooking dirty means. That gig was a job that I had taken at a, as is probably obvious, an incredibly awful crab shack in Tampa, Florida. I had moved down there with my ex in some misguided attempt to save our relationship after leaving a gig where I was the chef, not quite an exec, but a chef enough at a nice French restaurant in upstate New York, doing great work with guys that I loved, and it just all imploded one day. The story is in the book, in case any of you are curious, but it all imploded, and I had nothing else to do. I had a few bucks in the bank, and we decided to run for Florida. I spent the rest of my time in Florida, essentially, cooking dirty. Now, the original title of the book, Whiskey Down, the order of toast, everything else, they actually brought that title up at an editorial meeting at my publisher's office. This, you know, I don't know if any of you understand how book publishing works, because I certainly fucking didn't when I started all this. I had no idea. I didn't realize that it really is a meritocracy. You've got a book, an editor has read it, and then everybody in a room has to agree that this is the book that they want to publish. Every single person in the room, meaning salespeople, occasionally secretaries, assistants, certainly the editors, the bosses who are, you know, publishing the work of really important writers, not two-bit ex-fry cooks like me, they brought it in, and they read pieces of it. Some people had seen it, and they were discussing it, and their big problem was the title, Whiskey Down. They went around the room, and they actually took a show of hands. Does anybody in this room understand what his title actually means? There was only one girl who raised her hands. One girl in an entire room full of publishing industry professionals who'd spent her time working her way through college in restaurants. She was the only one who got it. They immediately told me I was going to have to change my title. But one thing that did survive into the final edition of the book was the scene where Whiskey Down is actually explained. I'm going to read that little section right now. I turned right to it. How weird is that? Not marked, no bookmarks, no nothing. Turned right to it. It's because I'm awesome, that's why. Oh, and I should also explain the only character in here who I'm going to read about now who deserves any explanation whatsoever is Wendy. This is a night at a job at basically a 24-hour diner that I had in New York. And I'm telling a story about one night at this place because one night was indicative of every night I spent at this joint. It was awful. It was terrible. The crew, myself included, were all just serious. We were just mercenaries. We were in it trying to get ourselves killed. It was one of the worst restaurant experiences I'd probably ever had. Therefore, the most fun I'd ever had in my life. Wendy, on this night in question, he was a new guy. he had been brought in because our old fryer guy had vanished, been arrested, run off to Mexico, whatever the hell happened. Nobody knew, but we needed a fryer guy. So we brought in the best applicant we had had, who was a guy whose only kitchen experience had been 3 months working at the Wendy's down the street. He's thrown onto our line on a Friday night bar rush. It's a toaster, Wendy. Bread goes in here, toast comes out the other end. I show him, laying two slices of white down in the little grated conveyor belt that will take it between the heating elements, spit it out browned into the chute on the other side. He nods, fascinated, like it's some kind of magic. I show him the box by a station where all the open bag loaves are kept, the racks outside the door with their shelves full of fresh bread, arranged by type, white, wheat, rye, sourdough, Texas, bags of bagels, hamburger buns, boxes of English muffins. It's a lot of bread. And then it's heavy breakfast business. It's a lot of bread, but then it's heavy breakfast business in the middle of the night. Almost everything goes with toast on the side. I explain. White and sour go through once, wheat and whiskey twice. Texas goes to the grill, that's me, because it's too thick to go through the machine. Unless it's French toast, that goes to Hero next to me. Bagels go through twice, EMs once. EM, English muffin. Got it? Wendy bobs his head. Sweat is running down the sides of his face, soaking his collar. The sweat is making his eyebrows shine. It's not even hot yet. Really? I ask. No, he says. What's whiskey? Rye bread. Why? Just is. Okay, he asks. What's Texas? Big place. Lots of cows. From Wendy, only puzzled silence. That's a joke, man. Texas toast. Thick cut. White. Big like Texas. Okay. Look, this is easy. One order of toast is two slices. Put them in, take them out, butter, slice, and stack them here on toast plates. Unless an order is dry, then there's no butter. Flag those somehow on the plate so you remember which is which. You've got three toasters, plenty of room. I'll call everything to you, so just listen and you'll do fine. Like if I say, one white, two wheat, one dry, one whiskey down, two Texas, my hand, one Texas for French, bagel dark, what do I need? Wendy stares at me blankly. I have no idea what you just said to me, man. Cooks raise the heart rate a little. I remember this stuff. Oh, God. Cook's Cockney. OE, Sonny, Po, no Po, waiting, dragging, on a weight, on the fly, to the board, to the grill, to the rail, on the rail, my hand, motherfucker, right fucking now. Then whiskey down, cakes down, fries down, tables up, and orders and fire orders. There are 1,000 ways to say fuck you, running from pissed off to downright tender, 1,000 ways to call for help. There's slang for every item on the menu, every special order, every kind of plate, wheel plate, big round, monkey dish, souffle, side, sometimes doubled up and tripled up slang for one thing, jargon that only makes sense if you were there on the night the term was born and are able to track its permutations across days and weeks. Like, we cook the occasional order of awful, mealy potato pancakes here. They are po' cakes in the wheel vernacular. They became hoe cakes one night after being ordered by a particularly skankish drunk woman in the dining room. Thanks. Makes me laugh too. That's all right. Became a hoe stack just because James thought it was funnier and because potato pancakes only came in one size, so there was less chance of confusing it with a standard cake order. Then became a haystack because that's kind of what potato pancakes look like when cooked. A haystack. Double haystack, bacon, well bacon, going apple jizz. That's two orders of potato pancakes, both with three strips of bacon. Second order, well done. The first with applesauce on the side. The second with sour cream. Anything white, any sauce, anything that comes out of a squeeze bottle, that's jizz. Really. It's like poetry sometimes. Fucking lyrical. After 10 minutes, I've given up trying to teach Wendy to recognize called orders. It's like trying to teach Spanish to a rock. We settled on a faintly mathematical par system. I told him, at all times, have waiting, 6 orders of white, 4 wheat, 4 sour, 2 rye, and 2 toasted English muffins. Keep half of this grill full of pancakes. The rest will cook to order, a la minute, until you catch on. If I ask for something and it's not there, I will kill you. No one will ever find your body. You got it? Wendy bobs his head. I slap him on the shoulder. You're gonna do fine. Craning across the pass to check the door, I see that we're still out in the clear. I check my watch. Brakes, I shout. Rotate out. Everybody, make it fast. James slides up next to Wendy. You smoke, little boy? Wendy says no. James shrugs. You should learn. Then he slides away. All right, that's it for that one. You know what, man? Seriously, I gotta tell you. I refused to read this book for a really long time. Like, after I finished it, even up until it was published, I refused to read it. My editing was done. I was so tired of it. I wanted nothing to do with it. This is only the second time I've cracked this thing since I finished writing it. I had to read like 2 paragraphs or a radio piece, and that was it. So this is really, it's been like 6 months or more since I've read this stuff. Can't believe I'm cracking myself up. That's just embarrassing. All right, I'm going to read one more piece, only because I promised my my daughter Parker I would mention her. So I'm going to read one last tiny little piece. I promise it will not take long, because I want her to hear her name too. It's also a funny story. So, the James Beard Award is the big one. The Academy Awards for food people, minus the gift bags and the red carpet. There are two ceremonies, one for writers and media people, another for chefs. And early in 2003, I was nominated for my first Beard Award for restaurant criticism for three pieces I'd written during my first couple months on the job in Denver, as I mentioned at the beginning. It was funny. I'd never made it to the Beard House as a chef. Wouldn't ever have made it while cooking. Not in a million years. But apparently, the minute I took off the whites, I was able to sneak in the back door with the journalists and hacks. Actually, I'm not sure whether that's funny or just a little sad. Laura and I flew out to the coast together, then drove into Manhattan for the awards gala. Having never before been to a gala and unsure what one was supposed to wear, tux, chaps, would spats and a top hat be too much or not enough? I'd called up one of the other nominated writers who'd been before and who was up against me in the criticism category that year. With complete innocent earnestness, I asked him what the appropriate attire was. "Oh, you don't need to dress fancy," he said. "It's a bunch of writers. It's not like everybody's going to be in tuxedos or anything." So taking my cue from him, I bought a $20 dress shirt at JCPenney and a tie to match. Laura wore a suit, black on black, and walking into the lobby of the Grand Hyatt where the shindig was being held, we, of course, saw everyone in jackets and ties. Polished shoes, half the men in penguin suits. I grabbed Laura's arm and held on tight as we plunged in, whispering in her ear that it was her duty as my wife to hunt down that other food writer and kill him should I die before I'd had the chance. We knew no one. We're known by no one. I was wearing this ridiculous-looking nominee ribbon that made me look like I just won third place at a grade school spelling bee. We each had one drink, sat in a corner, and were totally overlooked, so much so that no one even noticed when we ducked out and went across the street for sushi and tea, making it back just in time to find our seats in the ballroom as the ceremony was starting. Because we work for the same company, I was sharing space at table with the guy who told me I didn't need to wear a jacket, and you know what he was wearing? A fucking jacket! But let me say this. There is one thing that can make a $20 button-down from Penny's look good in a room full of expensive suits and ball gowns. Can you guess what that thing is? A fucking James Beard Award. When they called my name, I went up on stage, let them put the medal around my neck, thanked Laura, and got the hell off before I said anything to embarrass myself. By the time I got back to my seat, Mr. Don't Dress Fancy and his date were gone. I kissed Laura, then we ate their desserts. There were no limos, no big parties. After the awards were done, or rather there probably were, but none that Laura and I knew about or were invited to. We were geeks at the prom all over again. As everyone was making for the doors, I did manage to shake hands with Ruth Reichel from Gourmet. She's an incredibly short woman with a charming, shy smile and a formidable mass of curly hair like a show poodle trying to jump straight off her head. She congratulated me, which I thought was nice. She also called me Jerry, but that was okay. After that, there were photos taken of all the award winners. Because I worked anonymously, I stood proudly among my peers with my back to the camera, my medal draped between my shoulder blades. In the final picture, it looked like I was trying to sniff David Rosengarten's armpit. Shiny medal and a couple souvenir programs weren't the only things Laura and I brought back to Denver with us. For a couple of years, we'd been discussing what we would do about names if Laura ever got pregnant, either by accident or design. Our first thought was to sell the naming rights to large corporations as a way to finance the child's eventual college education or bail bond. While we understood that it might be rough on this wholly speculative kid to go through life saddled with a name like Kotex Wonder Mop Sheehan or Coors Light Presents Starbucks Invesco Sheehan, we figured that eventually he or she would come to understand. But what if no large corporation were willing to pony up? We wondered. Well, our backup plan had always been to name this purely hypothetical child after the place it was conceived, you know, like Denver or Mojave or Camry. As things turned out, my lovely daughter Parker ought to have been named Manhattan.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.